Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 30, and I'm joined by Richard Lee Jr., professor of philosophy and chair of the Department of Philosophy at DePaul University. He's published extensively in medieval and early modern philosophy, the Frankfurt School, and social and political philosophy. And his recent published works include The Force of Reason and the Logic of Force from Palgrave in 2002, and Science and the Singular, and the Question of Theology, Palgrave in 2002. No, 2002 was your first, and then
2004.
Right. He has published also in journals such as Telos and Hobbes Studies, Vivarium, and the Graduate Faculty Philosophy Journal. He's currently working on a project on the possibility of materialism that takes Hobbes as a clue. So it is this project that brings him to the digital dialogue today, in which we will discuss an essay entitled Reason, the Future and Sovereignty, Hobbes, and the Security of Time. Rick was also a colleague of mine at the New School, so this is a continuation of a theme on the digital dialogue of New School graduates. We had Falguni Sheth and Emma Bianchi in previous episodes, so welcome to the digital dialogue.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a great treat for me because you and I have had long conversations, and our friendship is one that I have always cherished as a genuinely philosophical one, where we could have not only good philosophical conversation, but also some fun and a little laughter. So I'm sure that'll come in. And let the record state that there is one beer. There's two beers in this room. So at the moment, so just as a full disclosure. So maybe Rick, you could talk a little bit about what you're trying to do in this essay and the larger project it belongs to.
Well, so my initial interest was not coming necessarily out of Hobbes, but out of a number of thinkers who were coming from a Marxist, Marxian perspective. So two I have in mind in particular were Louis Althusser and Adorno, who were, I think, to a large extent trying to figure out what, when you say it out loud, sounds like a relatively basic and maybe even silly question, but trying to figure out what a materialist philosophy could be. Because you have this, and here comes the part that seems a little silly. You have this basic problem that the philosophy of materialism is not itself material.
Right.
And so I read in Althusser and also Adorno ways in which they try to acknowledge this problem and, using Marx, think through it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my long-standing interest in Hobbes, I saw Hobbes also trying to think through this problem.
Right.
And so that's why I say that it's both a project about Hobbes, but then the larger issue is that Hobbes is an example, I think, of someone who thinks through these issues of what would constitute a materialist philosophy in ways that are instructive.
Right. And it seemed to me that, at least in this paper, and I know from your other work, that it's a materialist philosophy, but particular political issues are at stake for you. Certainly the question of force and violence.
That's right, because I think that there are two kinds of materialism that in these thinkers are particularly related.
Mm-hmm.
And one is what you might call like the metaphysical materialism,
right,
that whatever is matter.
Right.
There's nothing that exists or that has being that's not material.
Right.
That, and we can come back and talk about this, that I think is not dissimilar from a theological position, as strange as that may seem.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second materialism is something that I would call the materialism of social processes. So coming out of Marx, Marx would maintain that when you're thinking through a philosophical issue, you can't think that issue through seriously without taking into account the real material circumstances that make that condition possible,
right,
and so on.
Right.
And I think in Althusser and Adorno and Marx, they're trying to think about this issue. But what I find interesting about all three is that in trying to work this out, none of these three abandon reason. And often it seems like if you're a materialist, you have to say, well, reason's
just brain processes right. or something like that. Right. And none of them are reductive in this way, and I find that really fascinating. Yeah.
And so you're tracing that back in some ways to Hobbes.
To Hobbes, yeah, exactly. Okay.
And so in the and well, this is actually jumping a little bit ahead in the essay, but I mean it does seem to me that there's sort of an epistemological argument you make at least about the relationship between sensation and imagination in Hobbes, mm-hmm. and then the move that he makes to rationalization, right? Right? And then you sort of bring that right into the kind of political mm-hmm. context. So I mean, is there I was trying to think of a way to think about this, but this kind of epistemological politics or an epistemological side of the way you frame it, at least. Mm-hmm. But it's not just epistemology in a traditional sort of sense, right. as divorced from the other. I mean, let's say ontology and politics.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, and you know, it's there's this passage in Marx the introduction he wrote, although it wasn't published, to his contributions to the Critique of Political Economy. This is often published along with the Grundrisse, mm-hmm. In which the section is called The Method of Political Economy. Mm-hmm. And he says, if you look at people like Ricardo, Smith, these classical political economists, they tell you, we have to start with something concrete. And what could be more concrete than population? There are people. Right. So let's start with people. That's really concrete. And from there, then, we could build up and see how the economy functions. And Marx says the problem is that population is, in fact, an abstraction. Mm-hmm. Because when you say population, built into that are things like division of labor, wage labor, capital. Right. Right. And all of these, what seem to be abstractions, actually make this thing called population. And so Marx says the proper method should be to develop these abstractions till you get ever more determinate concepts, mm-hmm. which then are the real concrete. Mm-hmm. And I think Althusser takes this up, and Adorno in his own way take this up, as recognizing that the way to get to something other than thought. So my definition of what is matter mm-hmm. is that which is other than thought. And I think all three of these thinkers, in my argument, say in order to get to what is other than thought, we have no other way but through thought. And so I try to show the way in which Hobbes does this. So I think that there is a politics to this epistemology, mm-hmm. because the only way to get to this concrete reality, according to this tradition I'm interested in, is by looking at what you call these epistemological questions.
The story that you tell in this essay, I mean, you keep coming back to Marx, Althusser, and Adorno, because that must be – that's part of the bigger project, right?
Or the framework.
The framework, right.
That's right.
But in this essay, the way that you – or let's say the way that Hobbes brings it out is through – beginning with sort of the matter itself in the mm-hmm. sense that – I mean, you tell the story about the movement from sensation to imagination and into a kind of reason. And but what I hear you saying is you're there's a kind of reverse movement that you're thinking, namely from thought to matter.
Right. Well, because – so – to get into a bit of the technicality of the Hobbes issue, in one way, so Hobbes envisioned writing this three-part work that he called The Elements of Philosophy. And so the first part is De Corpore, on body. The second part is De Homine, on the human. And then De Cive, the citizen, the commonwealth, maybe. Mm-hmm. And he published the last part first because of the Civil War in England. Uh-huh. But the projected path was that he would begin in De Corpore with a discussion of method. Mm-hmm. So method starts first.
Okay.
And he
good
gets...
modern way.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's
we must be through the method first.
But, I mean, here's... To go back to your political epistemology, yeah. I mean, I happen to think that if you're interested in politics and you enter the discussion when people start talking about politics, you've entered too late. Yeah. The game's already over.
Right, right. It's already in method, for sure, right, at least.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly right. Right. So Hobbes, his initial trajectory was, we start with method, we get the questions of method clear.
Right.
We got to get what he calls ratiocination, which is addition and subtraction. We have to get clear with that, what names are, how they function, right. Clear definition of names, so on. And then his next section in De Corpore is called First Philosophy, which... Obviously, he knows this is one of Aristotle's names right. for this science or non-science that comes to be called metaphysics.
Right.
And yet, in that section, you see Hobbes taking on the sort of classic beasts of metaphysics: act, potency, mm-hmm. substance, accident, and recasting them in a completely material way.
Mm-hmm.
So far, however, we have no discussion of sensation, even though all the way at the beginning Hobbes maintains that all knowledge begins in sensation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not until part four that we get now a discussion of sensation, which, by the way, he calls the philosophy of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So the philosophy of nature begins with a discussion of sensation.
Okay.
And
that's in a good Aristotelian tradition in the sense of all living beings being beings that have sensation.
But it's also slightly non-Aristotelian.
Well, right.
In that he's interested in uncovering the way in which we're able to talk about right. nature.
Right. So really, he begins with. The site in which nature becomes accessible to living beings.
Well, and here he relies on the Greek and yeah. the middle voice, the phainestai.
Yeah, oh, phainestai, right, right.
Phainestai.
Well, that was one thing I wanted to talk about is the relationship between sensation and imagination here in Hobbes and how it gets played out.
Right. So, right, but so when he wants to talk about nature, his first thing is, well, what we're really talking about is that which, and so what would you say? I don't like the reflexive, but something like that which manifests yeah. or shows forth yeah. or something like
well,
that.
Well, in this Aristotle book I just finished, I talk about it as being appeared to.
Mm.
So you can get this idea of, you know, the middle voice because you're being appeared to, or you're also can appear to someone, but you're... when things appear to you that you're being appeared to.
Right.
So anyway, that would be perhaps a way of getting it into English. It's a little
yeah.
clunky, but maybe the clunkiness is good because it undermines our traditional ways of active-passive dichotomy.
And Hobbes was a translator. He translated right. Thucydides and some Homer.
Yeah, I love his Thucydides translation, by the way.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's very hard to read, but it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really true to the Greek.
Yeah, yeah. And so he's writing this in Latin, and he realizes... there's no way to render this in Latin.
Right.
And so he constantly uses the Greek word phenomenon. And when he comes to define what is phenomenon, his answer is to phainestai.
Right. There you go. Right. So it's the middle path.
That's right.
Right. So go ahead. Yeah. So that is really important because, I mean, from my perspective, you can do it with Aristotle. You can do it with Hobbes. But this movement from, let's just call it the site of encounter with, you know, what appears or what is appeared to. And then you can build up from there. Now, the story I try to tell in looking at Aristotle's De Anima in this new book on Aristotle and Truth is to try to tell a story about how from there through imagination to noesis, to noein, we have a movement and thinking then isn't a way nature expresses itself. For Aristotle now I'm talking. So I want to get back to this question of thinking as the other of matter because I wonder how sharp this, I mean, how serious this otherness is. Is this a real dichotomy, mm-hmm. Either on Hobbes' view or yours. Mm-hmm. But I'm also really interested in this transition, this transition from sensation through imagination to thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so one thing to note in Hobbes is that imagination and sensation are not different. So first point for Hobbes, sensation is nothing but resistance.
Mm-hmm.
In what sense? Well, there are bodies in motion. This is what we learn from first philosophy. There are bodies in motion, and this my body is also a body in motion.
Right.
Also, and this is especially important for Hobbes internally, which begins with the motion of heart. The motion of the heart.
Uh-huh.
He was really influenced by Harvey, and like we don't understand today how it freaked people out when Harvey said that the blood circulates and uh-huh. like this whole discovery. It like people's eyes were opened and they were suddenly like, oh my God. And today we think, oh, this is nothing.
But
right. this is when Hobbes talks, like, to jump ahead a bit, when he talks about passions,
right.
he says this is an affection of an affection of the vital motion. He means the motion of the heart.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, when I fear something, the motion of it is affecting the motion of my heart, and that the direction of those motions brings about resistance,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he calls sensation. And then when that sensation augments in a positive way my vital motion, we call that pleasure, and when it augments it in a negative way, we call that pain.
Right.
And then you get fear, flight,
pursuit.
Pursuit,
mm-hmm.
and then you get desire, and then you can build up a whole.
You've got action. You've got everything else.
That's right. All emotions you want, all the way up to vainglory and.
Well, yeah, and then
why
and then
people
and
want
here,
to be professors.
Right, talk about vainglory. Yeah,
there's
maybe
no
even associate deans too. But there you can see the story you just told. You can see the road that leads to politics, right? From the very materialistic kind of account of this resistance,
mm-hmm.
to you know, the question of political action and action and pursuit of pleasure, and as you pursue in this essay, I want to return to this because I thought this was a really provocative and important point, which was you problematizing all those politics based on the future and the notion of preservation for the sake of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, all right, so this story that we just began, or that we were just talking about, so let's throw it forward in fast and loose steps. It goes something like this. Okay, so there are those things that affect me, that help my vital motion, and those that hinder my vital motion. And therefore, I start seeking out those things which help my vital motion,
right.
and avoiding those things which hurt my vital motion. Okay, now here comes the big leap. But in contact with others, I come to realize that they're involved in the same situation too.
Right.
In which case, they're going to want my stuff. What stuff? The stuff that helps my vital motion that I've accumulated. So, you know, all
you
of
want
that.
Some more beer, don't you?
I do.
Here you go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because that helps my vital motion.
Here, let me help your vital motion here a little bit. There you go.
So then this leads to a struggle, mostly because I'm now have to protect myself against others.
Right.
But that protection of myself, if it's to be successful, means I have to project into the future,
right.
both your actions and how I'm going to respond. And one first effect of this in Hobbes is that I need more power, ever more power.
Mm-hmm.
And so the main result of all of this is that I need to seek what he calls power after power.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the only way, once I project this into the future, that's the only way I could begin to assure my security into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Then this is what leads to the state of war of all against all.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that story. It's an old story and so on. And then I realize with another futural projection
uh-huh.
that the best way out of this is for me to give up my right to everything, including your person, if you will do the same. But I only know you'll do the same if someone's going to run you through with the sword if you don't. Right? So we need some force that's going to keep us, hold our feet to the fire on this. That's the construction of the sovereign. And so my argument about Hobbes is that everything we find objectionable in Hobbes, that the sovereign is absolute, this absolute authority, that, you know, even though Hobbes says, well, I can defend my life when the sovereign wants to take it, that's true, but the sovereign can also take it. Right. So he never denies that. So the absolutism of Hobbes, everything we object to in Hobbes, I argue, is based on this notion of securing the future, that it's a futural projection in which I try to secure the future.
Okay, I found that really compelling, that whole story, and I mean, and the way in which you weave it into a critique of sort of contemporary American politics.
There's
and
a butt coming. I sense it already.
Yeah, well, I said, well, like, I buy all this. Okay, okay, good.
But
that's your phone.
That is my phone.
All right, can we ignore it or
yeah? No, ignore it.
Ignore the music in the background. So the butt. What was the butt? Let me get my mind back into it.
After the Bachman-Turner Overture, right,
it was very nice. So we have this the future, right? So the assertion of security and the assertion of power. So you even just now said sort of there's a double movement of the future, right? So there's the projection of the future, and it's really a second projection. Namely, I'm realizing this war of all against all is just not feasible. Mm. Okay, at some point, now, I'm not sure we've gotten to that point yet where we recognize that, but anyway, it's not feasible. And so there's a second sort of movement to project to the future and say, okay, we need to agree somehow, right, that we're, and not only agree, but there has to be this sovereign power, right?
Right.
So I guess the issue was that I wanted to emphasize was, are you just describing, or are you being critical of that logic of violence that you lay out at the beginning of the essay with regard to, you know, the mafia.
And
although I do want to have a larger discussion about the theme of the mafia in your work, because there's a couple of papers on Sherman that start in this mafia way with the Godfather. So we're going to have a discussion about that. But I like the way it started with the Sicily and all of that. And this is going to go to a longer conversation we've had over many years about sort of, are we talking just about a kind of description and you're going to leave it at that, and we're talking, and let's just be realistic about the force, and the force has to be there to maintain something, or are you trying to think against and through that somehow?
Yeah, okay. So
that was the butt somewhere in there.
But you're trying to catch me on the thing you always try to catch
on.
That somewhere.
And now it's on tape.
Somewhere, somehow, when I'm critical of what's going on, I'm smuggling in a kind of normativity, which you're fine with, but you want me to become honest with it. And I always smell that Levinas is right around the corner.
Well, and I want to be, I mean, I want to face up to my own tendency to be perhaps a little too hopeful and a little too utopic in some way, right? Because I definitely want to avoid any kind of utopian strand. But yet I do think that probably my we've had this discussion before where I want to push in the direction of, okay, yeah, but what then? Where do we go from here?
So
okay, yeah, violence, violence. We know that.
Right, okay. But I want to say two things to that.
Okay.
One thing... I'll just lay it out and we can come back to it, is I think that we have not yet thought through as thoroughly as we can the actual operation of violence in the form of our desire to secure the future.
And we can come back to Lee Edelman's No Future text in a discussion of that.
Okay.
But here's another thing that maybe you don't want recorded for all of posterity, but don't you ever wonder that, like, I read these amazing books about construction of a new ground for ethics and, you know, ethics has to be constructed on the basis of a responsibility without end, Derrida's politics of friendship and so on. Mm-hmm. And I don't have anything to disagree with about, but don't we have to sometime acknowledge that that leaves people untouched? Like, mm-hmm. people are not now behaving in new ways because this has been said.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two things I would say in response to your question is, yes, I could talk about the discovery of a new ground for normativity or something like that, but is that going to change how people act?
Well, I mean, I guess so. Two things, and I do want to come back to the operation of violence. But I think the question is an important one. And actually, in some ways, this whole project with the digital dialogue and the whole idea of trying to cultivate excellences of dialogue and of, you know, be it philosophical or, you know, throughout one's life, is in some ways my attempt to think about something where the rubber hits the road, where, you know, what the way we engage with one another, the way we talk to one another, and then how we respond to one another really does determine the kind of relationships we have and the kind mm-hmm. of possibilities mm-hmm. that we will create as a community. So mm-hmm. I really want to take that seriously. On the other hand, I completely agree with you and want to be honest about, you know, the fact that we, in a certain sense, we can't annihilate that dimension of violence, that dimension of force that is always operating in every relationship, no matter how, you know, peace-loving and understanding we want to be. Mm-hmm. I think the danger, and we've had this discussion before, and as students of Rainer Schirmann, I think we need to recognize, and if we didn't learn this, we would have been bad students, is that, you know, the danger is the delusion that is not operating.
That's right.
So I'm definitely, I think we're on the same page about that. And what I find so compelling about this essay and really great is that, you know, it's so wonderfully picks out this idea that, well, everybody said, oh yeah, for the future, let's, you know, and I mean, even we could talk about it in terms of Heidegger and in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, the futurity and the kind of privilege, okay, equiprimordiality, we know, but there's a kind of at least heuristic priority that the future has in Heidegger that probably fits in an interesting way into your essay here. But yeah, this, you know, for the sake of the future leads to, you know, some things that are pretty, as we've lived through in the past few decades in the United States, pretty horrible.
Right.
You know? And I think that, I mean, the question is it just a matter of pointing that out, or are we doing something with that?
Right.
Not necessarily that we have to construct a new foundation of X, Y, or Z. And I'm as, you know, again, I'm with you on the idea of, not wanting to construct, and we've had this discussion with regard to Adorno and the positive moment versus the negative moment.
Right,
I think it's not about constructing a new ethics or a new constructing anything.
Right.
The problem is the dynamics and the logic of construction is problematic.
Right. No, I agree with you, and so it seems to me that I would argue that philosophy in particular has two tasks it performs that are not distinct in the sense that we don't ever know when we're teaching, for example,
right.
which task we're actually performing. On the one hand, there would be this task of if you don't want to call it critique, at least analysis.
Mm-hmm. I'd call it critique too, Uncle.
Okay. So critical analysis or something like that. So, for example, even this morning on, I think it was the Diane Rehm show, I heard a discussion about Obama's new debt commission. Mm-hmm. And Obama also keeps saying this is a burden we can't pass on to our children and so on. And it's not, first of all, immediately clear to me that we can't pass it on to our children. Why not? I mean, I don't have children, so why can't we pass it on to them? Didn't we have burdens passed on to us, and not just in the form of debt, but, for example, my grandfather was a house painter, and he wanted his children to go to school. Only one of them went to school, and then all of my brothers and sisters went to college, and many of us have advanced degrees and so on. And that's a burden in a way that has been passed on to me by the past. Mm-hmm. I think this is the argument Benjamin makes in the Theses on the Philosophy of History. Mm-hmm. But by burden, I don't mean necessarily anything negative. I mean, that's part of what I'm responsible for.
Right.
I have to try to, this is my weak messianic power, I have to try to make good on that.
Right.
But so it's not clear to me I can't pass off our debt, trillions and trillions of dollars to our children.
But I mean, just because I wanted to get to the second part of this, but just to interject there, I mean, there's a way in which the appeal to the future is in the vocabulary and in the polemics that you're referring to in contemporary American political polemics is rooted in a kind of, okay, where's the question of responsibility and what are we responsible to?
Right.
And there's a way in which, after reading your essay, I'm more and more convinced that actually it's not to this unknown future so much, and this is related to what I try to argue in the Aristotle book, it's to the present and the elusive dimension of our relations with one another in the present that is actually what we need to be accountable for, rather than this projecting of security to an unknown future.
Right.
Right. And so if we shift that, now I may be doing something all problematic from a different perspective by shifting, the site of responsibility.
But, I mean, even last night, Will McNeil, my colleague, was pointing out, and I think rightly, that one of the remarkable things about this thing Aristotle calls phronesis is its, what would you call it? Presentism, or the ability to seize on the present its
fullness. I mean, in the complexity,
ambiguity, cloudiness, but to take all of that in and yet recognize I still have to do something.
Right.
Well, this is bird meat. I must eat it.
Right, exactly. A very good reference to the News and Logos article that we wrote together, which we will put a link to on the website. Exactly. That should have been mentioned, that we co-authored two articles on here, but I'll put it on the blog post. So this is a continuation of that. And I think the whole vocabulary of the Kairos and how that exists in the Aristotelian text is exactly related to this, and then taken up by Heidegger and others. But
okay, so this is about my work, but let me ask you a question about that.
Okay.
Because I got into this argument the other night about, do you know D'Etienne and, did he write that with Vernant? The book on Métis. So I'm a little bit convinced by them that...
You were talking to Sean probably about this. No,
I was talking to Sean Kirkland and also Will McNeil.
Right.
Both of whom want to privilege, I shouldn't say privilege, but were saying, well, Métis is a little base and dirty and underhanded and sneaky, and Phronesis is better.
Oh my God.
And I'm a bit convinced by D'Etienne. And is that Vernant he wrote that with?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm convinced by their argument that, there is something in Métis that is never left behind by Greek thought.
Well, right. No, and I draw on that essay in my essay that was published in the Graduate Faculty Philosophy Journal, The Daughters of Métis, and I try to to trace that out, particularly, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that article because it relates to the question of sovereignty. So I trace from Agamemnon and the relationship. Oh, actually, I begin with Zeus and this impulse to swallow Metis, right? Mm-hmm. And because she's the wisest and smartest, and actually the Greek says, in order so that they may think together. Mm. So my point was, when Apollo says in the Eumenides that Athena has no mother, no, she does have a mother. The mother has been incorporated into Zeus. Mm. And it's really the ongoing continuation of that political knowledge, the metis, as phronesis. And it's really interesting because of if they're talking about it as a little bit dirty, it's very interesting from a gender question, because the one reading is that Zeus appropriates and swallows and oppresses Metis. Mm. But one, if you read the Hesiod, and I try to trace this out in this article, first of all, Zeus is listening to his mother and grandmother.
Yeah, yeah.
And they say, you know, do in a certain sense, you know, you need to do this in order that he wouldn't have a son that's more powerful than he
is. That's right.
He swallows her, and then Athena pops out of his head, fully, you know, born.
Right.
And so one really needs to think about, you know, what is this figure of Zeus who's taken over the feminine in this kind of way, taken the feminine into his belly, and the whole vocabulary of the womb and the belly. So I try to play that out in order to think through the whole question of how sovereignty is established. And this question of violence, but it's also a bringing of this capacity for, you know, trickery, as well as for political acumen and wisdom, into oneself in a way, and as the Greek says, so that they together can rule. So I don't. My reading is not that there is a complete eclipse of Metis. That right. Metis, as you're suggesting, is, I like and that. I draw on Vernon's and Etienne's text to try to make that argument. But then I play it into the Agamemnon Iphigenia relationship, and then ultimately into the Eumenides, where Athena sort of performs it, because she does choose for Orestes, but she incorporates the Furies into the city by convincing them to give up their fury.
Right.
And she does that by honoring them and by giving them a place. And that's what convinces them. And so, but see, that's actually related exactly to the point we're trying to talk about, which is, okay, Athena, in that text, and I make reference to it, says, look, I have the thunderbolts. I know I got the key to the closet where the thunderbolts are. So don't make me go there to the Furies.
Right.
And there is an appeal to force.
Right.
But don't make me use it.
Right.
And they, you know, are, because she doesn't appeal to force and then, you know, tell them to go live in a corner, says, no, I could use force, but look, let me give you a place of honor.
Right.
Be part of this.
Right.
So then, you know, so that's a kind of model, and I think there's Metis operating in there.
Right, and I've argued that, I mean, this is also very interesting in Prometheus, because at the opening of that, who comes to talk to Prometheus? Kratos and Bia.
Right.
And they're sort of, their complaint.
Force and violence, yeah.
Force and violence, yeah. And their complaint to Prometheus is, there was an established order, and you backed this upstart. I mean, you were part of this established order. You backed the upstart, and so you used violence, or you engage. You at least backed the party that was using violence to overthrow the established order. And Prometheus, if he has any response, and I think Hesiod is also responding in a certain sense. So this must have been a problem the Greeks were worried about.
Right.
The answer is, but the violence that Zeus and the Olympians used vis-a-vis the Titans was because they were violent in a way that established no order.
Right.
So Kronos had no order. There was no order.
Right.
And he was very violent.
Right.
And not to mention, I mean, go back to Uranus.
Vernon and Etienne make the point that actually the violence of Uranus is pre-political, and the first political violence is Kronos.
And I think, I would even say maybe Kronos is not political violence.
I forget the argument. It may be that Zeus. I forget what that argument is. I had to look at that.
I mean, I read Hesiod as trying to establish the legitimate sovereignty of Zeus.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
And Aeschylus as well. Right. I think.
Yes, and I think so. And what I find interesting is that sovereignty is not just about the domination of the use of force. What establishes Zeus's authority in Hesiod is not that he can use force. The logic of force operates with Ouranos and Kronos. They try to swallow and repress. It's Zeus who listens to his mom and grandmother to use logos to give a position of authority honor the past and honor the gods of the past. And that's what gave him the thunderbolts in the first place.
But so you say all of that, and yet you don't understand why I'm interested in the mafia and particularly these popular depictions of the mafia.
I mean,
when Michael Corleone says to Kay at the beginning of Godfather 1, I'm not like my father, Kay.
Right.
What does that mean? So by the end of the Godfather trilogy, we learn that Vito Corleone, mm-hmm. Michael's father, has murdered really just one person. And I mean, we only are privy to even his ordering mm-hmm. the murder of just one person. Michael, on the other hand, like his first act is to kill the five heads of the
right.
family plus
right.
Mo Green in right. Vegas, and
in
all
the name
of this,
of legitimacy.
All of this in the name of legitimacy.
Right. Right. Well, no, I it's not that I don't understand your interest in it. I was just pointing out the thread, and
right.
it makes perfect sense. I wanted to go back to because. Okay, the logic of violence that Michael Corleone is caught up in, that Zeus in a certain way is caught up in, that we as a society, I think, are caught up in, which perpetuates itself. It is mm-hmm. absolutely unfeasible. It does not sustain itself. That's what Clytemnestra teaches us. Mm-hmm. You know, Agamemnon establishes authority by sacrificing Iphigenia. Clytemnestra kills him. And it's only when Athena comes with her full self to not only to decide for Orestes, but also to reason and persuade, we use reason and persuasion to make the Furies give up their claims,
right. yeah.
that some kind of city is established mm-hmm. that is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question is, well, okay, the logic of violence, the logic of force is not sustainable. And so something else has to happen, even that on your account of Hobbes. That's why we have to come to some agreement. Now, you're pointing out that is actually ultimately rooted in force. And I think Athena's appeal to the thunderbolts says that, too.
Right.
And I think, as we were talking, that's the point that we sometimes tend to forget
mm-hmm.
and want to cover over.
Right.
But
so, for example, and, I mean, the yeah. way I would say that in relation to Hobbes is that I think once the Commonwealth is constructed, or forget that even as a quasi-historical story, once I find myself in a Commonwealth,
mm-hmm.
I disagree with those who say that the state of war of all against all is thereby abandoned.
Right.
My argument is it's now personified in the sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
The sovereign is now the one who is able to unleash the violence of the state of war
mm-hmm.
as a threat. And so it's not gone. It's just put in the hands of the sovereign.
Right.
And that's in the name of security.
Right.
And so there's no way to secure the future without violence. We give it up. We give it up over to the sovereign. And so the violence of the what comes to be called in the later tradition the state of nature is still there in the person of the sovereign,
right.
Hobbes.
Right. And I guess the thing that needs to be constantly thought about, and this is actually related to the conversation I had with Falguni Shetla about her book on race, is how that sovereignty gets deployed
mm-hmm.
and redeployed. Deployed and redeployed, and how by placing it at the site of the sovereign, we have legitimated it in a certain kind of way, and that allows it to be deployed to discipline populations and cultures, and you know perpetuate a kind of a continuing war also. Mm-hmm. So there's, I mean, I agree with the idea that we can't be delusional and think that the violence or the that originary violence has now been overcome. And we do need to recognize it's always active. It's always operating in all, I would say, social political relationships of all kinds, right? The issue is, how can we be honest with ourselves about that and also relate in ways that are not, that are that attempt to minimize or somehow undercut some of the more damaging dimensions of that violence or way that violence is articulated.
Well, and this is why, I mean, to go back to the critical analytic part, I mean, one of the things I think we don't often realize is that I don't think we can engage, on the one hand, in this discussion about the future and the children, and on the other hand, be critical of what I call in the essay Bushism, this this notion that by any means we have to secure the future. I don't think you can do both of those at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so my first step is to try to show that and say, look, these are connected things.
Right, right.
The concern we have, and so I borrow this from Lee Edelman, his book No Future, that the notion that children are in political discourse the figure of the future. And he goes so far as to say we're being terrorized by children. And you mentioned earlier that you did an earlier one of these with Emma, but Emma Bianchi is the one who turned me on to that book.
See, it all comes back to the New School colleagues and everything. It's really amazing to see how where people have gone since those days at the New School. But let me now just say thank you, Rick, for coming on the Digital Dialogue.
It was a lot of fun.
Great.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.